a very sad end to a very sad chapter in Alaska history.
The state's litigation against Exxon for the Exxon Valdez oil spill comes to an end. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, on the opening day of AFN, protests over the Fairbanks 4 case.
Governor Walker, we have, on behalf of the Board of Directors and all of the delegation here, we have a very important message for you.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
26 years of litigation over the Exxon Valdez oil spill ended today in a federal district court in downtown Anchorage. The state and federal governments have decided not to pursue a final $100 million from ExxonMobil over its 1989 oil spill in Prince William Sound. From the Energy Desk, APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
It was an anticlimactic end to 2.5 decades of litigation. The hearing Thursday morning lasted all of 15 minutes, and no representative from Exxon spoke. Instead, Judge Russell Holland, who has overseen the Exxon Valdez case from the start, asked the state and federal government if they had anything to add to their written filing. They said no. So the judge himself spoke. "I understand that some will be displeased with the government's decision," he said, "but based upon what's in your report, I'm satisfied it was the right decision. What's clear to me is that the process has been lengthy, it's been extensive, it's been expensive."
It was extremely disappointing. I mean, this is a very sad end to a very sad chapter in Alaska history.
That's biologist Rick Steiner, who has followed the case since 1989 and pushed the state to seek the additional funds.
"It's an unconscionable betrayal of public trust. And above all, what it does in the end is it just validates the public's distrust of the oil industry and government promises of responsible oil development in Alaska."
At issue was a provision called a reopener clause. The government's original 1991 settlement with Exxon for $900 million allowed for additional claims in case of unforeseen environmental impacts. In 2006, the state filed for that money, citing impacts on harlequin ducks and sea otters from oil still lingering under the surface on Alaska beaches. But now the state and the Department of Justice say those species have recovered, leaving no grounds to go after that money. Department of Justice attorney Bill Brighton negotiated the 1991 settlement, and more recently, the proposed settlement over the 2010 BP oil spill. He says it's the right call.
"I think we have no lack of aggressiveness toward oil companies, but we also really believe in following what the science tells us."
And the science, he says, wasn't there. The government's claim focused mostly on two species. Other impacts that weren't included in the 2006 claim, like those on herring or killer whales, couldn't be considered by the court. And by 2013, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council had found that harlequin ducks and sea otters had recovered.
"We've investigated this claim very thoroughly, and we've reached the point where it's clear that further pursuit of the particular narrow claim that was under the reopener isn't an appropriate thing to do."
The government's litigation over damages to the environment is separate from the private litigation on behalf of fishermen and local residents. That ended in 2008 when the Supreme Court approved a settlement of $500 million, much lower than the $5 billion a jury originally awarded. Brighton says regardless of feelings about the private litigation, the government settlement has been a success.
"And I understand the feeling, particularly the a feeling of a need for even more retribution, and I certainly don't want to say anything positive about the way the private litigation ended up going, but on the side of the claims of the government, I think we have a very, very favorable and fair resolution."
The state and feds stress that while this is the end for the courts, it's not the end for restoration work in Prince William Sound. The trustee council still has $200 million for that work from the original 1991 settlement. As for Judge Holland, "My colleagues have been fretting for 14 years that some of this litigation might outlive my time on the court," he said. "Happily, that hasn't happened." From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
At its convention last year, AFN endorsed Dan Sullivan's opponent in a tense campaign, and Congressman Don Young apologized to the audience for remarks he'd made about a teen suicide. What a difference a year makes. Sullivan today addressed the audience as their junior U.S. senator, and Young was all smiles. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sullivan focused his speech on one of his political strengths, military issues, specifically veterans.
We have in this room, we have a room full of heroes. We have a state full of heroes. We have a country full of heroes.
It was right in line with the convention theme, Heroes in Our Homeland. Sullivan mentioned that he's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Reserves and just finished 5 days of reserve duty. But he used much of his speech to highlight the military service of Alaska Natives.
Let me say that again. Think about that. Alaska Natives serve at higher rates than any other ethnic group in our military in the United States. That's World War... Yeah, that deserves another round of applause, doesn't it?
He named a few Native leaders who are vets, Bill Thomas, Emil Nadi, Oliver Levitt, Walter Sobolov, both junior and senior. Some, Sullivan said, came home to racial discrimination and lack of opportunity.
No matter how poorly you were treated by your government, when you were called to serve, you did it. That is a special kind of patriotism.
Sullivan says he wants to reestablish National Guard units in rural Alaska, a goal he shares with Governor Bill Walker, but the senator warns it will be a long, tough fight. He drew applause when he spoke of a bill he sponsored to allow Native vets of the Vietnam era apply for 160-acre allotments. The Alaska delegation to Congress has argued for years that many vets missed the deadline for applying in 1971 because they were serving their country. Sullivan told the convention he testified for the bill at a Senate hearing.
But what's a little bit disturbing to me is the Obama administration is opposed to my bill, saying that it's not equitable, that it's not fair.
The administration also objects because the bill would allow claims on national forests and wildlife refuges, and the Interior Department says it's finally finishing the claims of Native Vietnam vets who filed the last time Congress reopened the application period for them in the 1990s. Young spoke briefly, and though cheerful, he made several references to his own mortality, or maybe the end of his career, it was hard to tell. But he talked about being at the dawn of AFN.
And I'm beginning to see the sunset, personally. But every time that I'm so happy, what I see is coming behind me. The young people, the people who have gone to college, the people who are working, the people who are helping running the corporations, the village corporations, the people who have the belief and the pride in being an Alaska Native.
Young is 82, but he just got married, and he closed by saying he'd always be there for Alaska Natives as long as God and the voters agree. With help from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin in Washington.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a master weaver talks about learning her craft from her mother.
It really took me like 2 years before she thought I was ready. In fact, when I start weaving, she burned my baskets for like 3 or 4 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
People who say they were with the Fairbanks Four the night of John Hartman's 1997 murder recount aggressive questioning by police trying to build a case against the men. The witnesses, who were also teenagers at the time, George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent were arrested for beating the 15-year-old Hartman, took to the stand yesterday at a month-long hearing being held to determine if the four convicted of the crime are in fact innocent. Conan Goble recalled being questioned by former Fairbanks police detective Aaron Ring about downtown partying the night of the Hartman killing.
He was trying to fabricate something that wasn't true.
Goble said the conversation with Ring deteriorated and the detective ended the tape-recorded interview.
He turned it off and he looked right at me and he said, "If you don't tell me what I need to hear, then I'm going to make sure that you get arrested for this as well."
State prosecution team attorney Ali Rehoy questioned Goble's accounting of his conversation with Ring by referring to interview transcript passages Goble did not recall.
Safe to say that your memory's not so clear about what went on in the interview?
It was a long time ago, so it's safe to say certain parts I don't remember. Other parts I do.
Goble and most other witnesses called by lawyers representing the Fairbanks Four offered vague timelines, placing the four at other locations when Hartman was beaten. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports that one witness, Gareth Edwin, said he clearly remembers Marvin Roberts' presence at a wedding reception at the estimated time of the Hartman attack. Fairbanks Four supporters protested during Governor Bill Walker's address to the crowds during opening day at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage today. People held up four fingers and held a banner reading, "Justice Fairbanks Four." KBBI's Stacia Eaton has more.
The protest began about a third of the way through Governor Bill Walker's address to the crowd during the first day of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, just as the governor addressed the Fairbanks Four issue.
"Please don't hold back any of your passion or frustration with me as a result of that. You're entitled to that. Because of what you have done, your passion, they are in trial today. They are getting their day in court today. So keep that up. I fully understand that."
KNBA journalist Jocelyn Estes described the scene as she hosted a live broadcast of the event.
A proclamation recently.
So a crowd of people at the one side of the room are holding up a sign that says "Justice Fairbanks 4," and they're holding their hands up in the air.
As protests go, it was polite. Protesters occasionally shouted, "Free the Four." After the governor's talk, the AFN board and delegates came to the stage and asked the audience to stand together, raising four fingers for the Fairbanks Four. As protesters erupted, AFN co-chair Anna Hoffman from Bethel requested that the governor deliver justice on the issue.
Governor Walker. Governor Walker, we have, on behalf of the Board of Directors and all of the delegation here, we have a very important message for you. Free the Fairbanks Four.
The delegates to the convention are on their feet, raising their hand.
No more four. No more four.
After the event, Misty Nikolai from Fairbanks said she was drawn to join the movement to free the men when her sons were nearing the age that the Fairbanks Four were when they were arrested. She says it's not just an issue for her family and community, though.
It's also an issue for all of Alaska, not just Indigenous people. These Fairbanks Four are a part of the power minority, and yes, they're all Native American, Native Alaskan. However, it could have been any power minority. So this is a human issue. This is an issue for Alaska, and it affects all of our citizens.
The hearing for the Fairbanks Four is expected to continue through October. George Freese, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Peace remain jailed. Marvin Roberts is out on parole. The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention runs through Saturday in Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Alaska Natives from all across the state are in Anchorage this week for the annual Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. The keynote speaker is Haida Master Weaver Dolores Churchill and her grandson, Haida Master Carver Donald Varnell. This fall, Churchill was in Petersburg to hold a weaving workshop and talked with KFSK's Angela Denning about her life.
This one is red cedar bark. This is spruce root. So,
dressed in black with her silver hair neatly parted to one side, Dolores Churchill sits on a couch surrounded by photos of her work. Some are in albums and others are spread out on the seat, and she can remember details of each one.
But this is some sand, and this is lingot. So that one must have been Haida down below.
Churchill was born on Canada's Queen Charlotte Islands. She started weaving at age 5 at school as a way for Haida-speaking children to learn English. The weaver was Churchill's mother, Selina Paradovich.
And because she was my mother, I wouldn't listen. I just kept making my own style basket.
She doesn't remember the details, but the basket wasn't cylindrical like her mother wanted. The school's baskets were sent on to a contest in Victoria, British Columbia, where Churchill's won first place. The prize was a whopping $5.
In 1930, $5 was like $100 now. So my mother called me to the front. She gave me the blue ribbon. And then she called my best friend up, and she gave her the $5. I was so angry. The blue ribbon she had pinned on me, I threw on the ground, and I stomped on it and said, I hate basketry anyway.
Churchill didn't try weaving again until she was an adult. She realized that the only Haida weavers left were her mother and sister, so she decided to take a class at the community college in Ketchikan where her mother was teaching. At first, her mother didn't want her in the class, but the head of the art department convinced her otherwise. Learning the craft was a good thing, too, because now Churchill is known all over the world as an expert Haida weaver of baskets, robes, hats, and other regalia. She uses spruce root and red cedar bark.
With the cedar bark, all you do is pull the bark off the tree, you split it in several layers, and then you could pull it through a stripper so that you have even warp and even weft.
Spruce root weaving is even more difficult, starting with finding the right tree roots. Then the roots have to be split and graded uniformly with the same width and thickness. Churchill says preparing materials for weaving takes a lot of practice.
Especially spruce root, because you're putting it in your mouth when you split it, and you're holding it between your teeth. I still have a lot of my mother's warp that she split, and they're paper thin. I still can't do it that paper thin. I never will.
Learning from her mother, who was a nationally recognized weaver, was no small thing.
It really took me like 2 years before she thought I was ready. In fact, when I start weaving, she burned my baskets for like 3 or 4 years.
Burned them?
She did, because she thought they weren't good enough, because she said, if you tell somebody I taught you and you have a lumpy, bumpy basket, I don't want you to tell them I taught you. So she burned them.
Now at age 86, Churchill doesn't hold it against her mother.
I think I'm a lot like her, and so she always was very independent and did things her own way.
Although Churchill is Haida, she's mastered other styles of weaving beyond her own tribe.
And I just did the Haida, the Tsimshian, and the Tlingit cresting wave. And this is...
Churchill studies a photo of a basket she made. She says it's not the pattern or the material that makes it one tribe or another. It's the technique.
Haidas hold it upside down, and then the Tsimshian hold it right side up, and then the Tlingits hold it right side up.
Tlingits also use maidenhair fern and grass to decorate. But the knowledge of how to create it, that part, Churchill worries, is on its way out. There are efforts to keep it alive, though, and Churchill is a part of that. But she says it takes a special motivation.
You know, you get so little for your weaving that it actually has to be somebody really dedicated to weaving. You could make more being a secretary. You could make more even being a maid.
Even though weaving can take years to master, Churchill feels hopeful. She says there are some excellent weavers around, like in Hoonah, and if they teach others the skills that they know, then the intricate craft will not die out. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Learn more about Linfield at the Anchorage College Fair on Sunday, October 18th, or at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
Governor Bill Walker says he'd love for Alaska to be the first state without homelessness. With a little inspiration from the state of Utah, some are hopeful that could become reality. In 10 years, the number of people who are chronically homeless in Utah dropped from 1,964 to 178. Lloyd Pendleton, director of Utah's Homeless Task Force, was a guest at the meeting of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness annual conference. He said the solution was relatively simple. Utah used the Housing First model. If funding is the problem, Pendleton suggested that Alaska's permanent fund dividends could be put to a higher use, which Corrections Commissioner Rob Taylor found amusing.
You're not talking about our checks, are you?
Pardon?
You're not talking about our PFD checks, are you?
Yes, I guess that's what you call them. So you pay no sales tax, you pay no tax. The rest of us down in the lower 48 go with that issue. I'm just saying you have an opportunity to rethink seriously your whole structure.
Short of implementing new taxes or doing away with PFD checks, Pendleton noted that Alaska is in a good spot to make progress on a housing initiative. Governor Walker said a recent visit to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks opened his eyes to new technologies that can help residents mitigate expensive winter heating bills.
So it's not any one particular, you know, region. It's statewide that we need affordable housing. You know, some locations in our great state in the winter, multiple families move together to live in one house. So they're heating one house rather than four houses. Quite a challenge. There's no place else in the United States that does that, that people live in those conditions.
The state will hold a housing summit in January. Walker says he hopes it will identify what the state can do to help local communities address their housing needs. Several of Juneau's homeless live at the city-run Thane Campground. For $25 a week, it may be the cheapest rent in town. Today, the campground closes for the winter, leaving some occupants wondering where to go. KTOO's Lisa Fu has the story.
Elliot Scott moved from his hometown of Bakersfield, California, to Juneau in April.
It's a good place to get a new start, to be able to better your life.
Scott is 33. In 2004, he was arrested for a felony in California. After serving 3 years, Scott found himself in and out of jail more than 20 times for parole violations.
It just happens over and over and over and over and over until you finally get out of the system.
Scott got off parole in April. He took a job with Alaska Canopy Adventures and lived at the Prospector Hotel for an employer-subsidized rate of $450 a month. When the tourist season ended, so did the housing.
He bought a tent, bought a tarp, had a sleeping bag,
and moved to the Thane Campground, about 1.5 miles from downtown Juneau. Scott works at Western Auto Marine, takes a marine transportation class at University of Alaska Southeast, and wants to get his captain's license. He's paying out of pocket because the course doesn't qualify for financial aid.
Going back to school cost me $1,100 and being homeless.
On top of tuition, Scott is paying off criminal fines in California.
So if you add that into the equation of housing and gas and foods, it's like a house payment. So you go without.
He does laundry and takes showers at the downtown laundromat.
When I go to work, I'll go take a shower and I'll get nice and cleaned up. Nobody ever knows.
At about $8 for a load of laundry and $2 a shower.
It adds up quick, but you gotta do what you have to do.
When the Thane campground closes, Scott isn't sure where he'll live. The city and borough of Juneau leases the Thane campground land from AJT Mining Properties, owned by Avista Corporation. According to the lease, the purpose of the campground is to provide campsites with proper facilities for seasonal housing during the temperate months of the year. Its primary goal is to provide housing, not recreation. Chris Day is an administrative assistant for Parks and Recreation, which runs the campground.
It's kind of a placement for those that don't really have anywhere else to go, just somewhere that they can stay temporary where they know that if they're able to follow the rules, that they can stay at a relatively good price.
On its last night before closing, 7 of the 18 available camp spots were occupied. Day says 3 people have stayed at the campground the entire season. Others stay for 1 or 2 months. From mid-April to mid-October, he says the campground is usually more than 80% full. Besides the Thane campground, there aren't other options in Juneau for long-term camping with facilities on public-run land. State and federal campgrounds limit how long you can stay. U.S. Forest Service Recreation Program Manager Ed Grossman says the campgrounds are not for permanent occupancy.
We're in the recreation business. We're not in the seasonal housing business, no matter what your situation, whether you're homeless or a low-income job.
Maria Lovashuk is executive director of Juneau's Shelter and Soup Kitchen. She gets worried when the Thane campground closes. She says some who live there are considered at risk of dying prematurely, including a 65-year-old man she recently interviewed as part of a homeless survey.
What closing the campground will mean is that he won't be in one place. Like, he'll have to move several times. It's so hard to set up a camp in the winter, like, and to find stuff. I think, like, in the summer, it's, like, a little bit less critical, you know, because you have, like, a little bit more time and resources and then body energy to, like, survive this element. And in the winter, you really don't.
For Elliot Scott, he has a month left in his marine transportation course. If he doesn't find proper housing by the time that ends, he may leave Juneau. In the meantime, he's looking for another place to camp. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Department of Fish and Game has issued an emergency order allowing hunting for muskox stranded on sea ice starting today. The order affects Unit 18 in southwest Alaska. The area's assistant biologist, Patrick Jones, says the order is meant to help curb muskox overpopulation. Hunters can take muskox if they're stranded on free-floating ice completely surrounded by salt water.
They're not swimmers. They're not going to swim. They're going to ride that chunk of ice out until they starve or they fall in the water and drown.
Jones says the recent mild winters have helped increase the muskox populations. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholt, Stacia Eaton, and Jennifer Canfield in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Lakita Chavis in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.